Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we examine Donald Trump's historic visit to North Korea, the first sitting U.S. president to do so. We go through the complicated, important, and complex history of U.S.-North Korean relations. And finally, we juxtapose the winning that President Trump is accomplishing on the international stage with the insanity of the modern Democrat Party. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show. Summer action is heating up in the beginning of July with a lot of excitement in Major League Baseball, the Women's World Cup, UFC, MLS Soccer, NBA Free Agency, and the presidential debates are now starting on the Democrat side. There's only one place that has you covered and one place we trust, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use that promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. And for those of you that might have been really big on the Golden State Warriors, I told you not to bet on them because they're not good, and you would have done great because of the Toronto Raptors. Go Raptors, Warriors, so glad to see them lose. And guess what? You could bet on politics too. The presidential odds and Democrat nominee have been updated. Harris was a plus 800. Now she's plus 350. Joe Biden, ooh, low energy Joe Biden. He was plus 175 to plus 400. And Julian Castro went plus 5,000 to plus 2,500. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use that promo code PODCAST1 or text BETNOW to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag. It's a great service. You got to use it. Your online sports book experts. What's up, everybody? Hope you had a great weekend. Now, if you were like me, I'm sure you were up at 3 o'clock in the morning Eastern watching our great president, President Trump, walk into North Korea. I'm sure all of you are doing exactly the same thing, right? I'm only half kidding. I got a lot of messages, got a lot of Facebook posts and Instagram posts of people saying, Charlie, can you make sense of this for me? Because this feels like it's a really big accomplishment. This feels like this is a breakthrough. This feels like it's historic, but the media is telling me this is wrong, this is dangerous. Can you please clarify this for me, especially on your podcast, The Charlie Kirk Show? So our team, we kind of decided to do another flash episode of The Charlie Kirk Show, and here we are today. Boy, was it an action-packed weekend, of course. So this all kind of started at the G20. So the G20 is an international forum that brings together the world's 20 leading industrialized and emerging economies. The group basically accounts for almost 85% of the world GDP and two-thirds of the population. And kind of one of the fun things that comes out of the G20 is all these interactions between these world leaders, that you're following these world leaders all throughout the year. You're following, you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. You're following Theresa May, and you're following Vladimir Putin. You might hate them, you might love them, irregardless, but all of a sudden you see they have to go together in a photo op together, and you see these people that might be exchanging the most vile things throughout the world. And I actually think the G20 is generally a positive thing for diplomacy and peace, because you're far less likely to go to war with a country if you're forced to actually sit down with them. And actually my favorite meeting, the whole thing, was seeing President Trump sit down with now reelected President Modi in India, who just won a huge victory. Modi is one of the most effective, not talked about enough, reformers in the world, who's really put forth market-based reforms, who has really consolidated power in a positive way. Some would say he's a horrible nationalist. I actually think he's a healthy nationalist in a lot of different ways. And it was actually President Trump, Prime Minister Abe from Japan, who's been terrific, and Modi had a really, really great meeting. President Trump sat down with President Vladimir Putin. You know, President Trump made a joke, God forbid the President of the United States ever makes a joke about fake news, and you start to see all these unbelievable articles come up saying that, well, of course the president likes Vladimir Putin because they both like going after journalists and all these sorts of things. The G20 is really all about the backroom meetings, though, outside of the cameras. That's really where the substance comes. That's where the diplomacy really happens. The president also met with Chairman Xi of China to help push a trade agreement over the finish line with China. And right now, at the recording of this podcast, stock market futures are already up. We'll see how that obviously ends up, but stock market futures are already up. And of course, he met with the great President Moon of South Korea. President Moon of South Korea came after a huge corruption scandal in South Korea, and I think he's been doing a terrific job helping open up dialogue with Chairman Kim in North Korea. And he's been working terrific with President Trump. And so while all this was happening, while President Trump, you have to imagine President Trump wasn't sleeping a lot during this. Anyone listen to this podcast? I'm sure you guys have done transcontinental flights. How difficult that is. Now I'm sure you're thinking, Charlie, come on. The president gets to fly in Air Force One. All right, fair enough. Fair enough. That's fine. But he also has to keep on taking calls, and he does have a country to run, for goodness sakes. But I don't remember Barack Obama working this hard on the international stage. I don't remember Barack Obama going through the G20, having all these meetings, trying to make deals as intentionally as President Trump is. And while all this was happening, while the president was barely sleeping, while the president was building consensus, while the president was meeting with our top allies from India to Japan, while the president was trying to work through a deal with our greatest enemy, China, because despite China being our greatest enemy, we still should have some form of trade with China. Did a whole podcast on China. I encourage you to go down and listen to that if you kind of want my clear thoughts on China. While all of that was happening, the Democrat clown show continued. And in fact, Senator Kamala Harris, who I predicted would be called the winner of the debate, because we did that podcast the night of the debate and all the morning shows, did in fact call her the big winner of the debate. Senator Kamala Harris went directly after President Trump. You know what? Let's hear what Senator Kamala Harris had to say.
We talked about, you asked before, what is the greatest national security threat to the United States? It's Donald Trump. And I'm going to tell you why. Because I agree, climate change represents an existential threat. He denies the science. You want to talk about North Korea? Real threat in terms of nuclear arsenal. But what does he do? He embraces Kim Jong-un, okay, a dictator, for the sake of a photo op.
Thank
Putin. You want to talk about
Senator
Russia?
Harris, we're going to
he
do
takes the word of the Russian president over the word of the American intelligence community when it comes to a threat to our
Thank
democracy
you,
and our election.
That's right. That's Senator Kamala Harris. Or is it Kamala, Mr. Producer? I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing. Kamala, Kamala, whatever. There she is saying that President Trump is the greatest threat to our country. The president who is literally brokering peace on the international stage at the G20. And so while the Democrats were trying to see who could be more like Chairman Mao, I'm totally kidding, by the way, Media Matters. I know you're listening to this. I'm half kidding. But if you look at their policies, they're becoming so radical. They're becoming so socialist. It's almost unrecognizable what they want to turn this country into. While they were doing that on the debate stage, President Trump was halfway around the world doing the hard work, doing the hard work. And a little more background. So initially, the G20 summit was limited to finance ministers and central bank governors about when it was established 17 years ago. But since then, an inaugural meeting between G20 leaders in Washington, D.C., following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, you probably remember that back in 2008, summits between G20 leaders themselves have become an annual event. I have to say, all these world leaders come when they go to meet with President Trump. They come with these big committees. They try to figure out President Trump. They all have their playbook. They all have their strategy. Oh, we have to have all this research. And he just confounds world leaders by his style, by his honesty. Do you know why he confuses them so much? Because he is exactly the same in private as he is in public. He's so authentic, they don't know how to deal with that. They're used to the Angela Merkel thing, where she's going to say one thing publicly about how much she loves Germany, and then behind the scenes go broker a deal to bring another 500,000 refugees to Germany. Or they're used to the Angela Merkel thing, where she says she wants what's best for Europe, when in reality she wants a currency bailout that's going to make Europe Germany again. That's what they're used to. And President Trump says exactly the same thing behind closed doors as he does in front of the press, as he does as a Make America Great Again rally, where he says, look, you've been ripping us off for a long time. You seem like a nice enough person, but why don't we get a deal done? Now, the huge news that came out of the G20 is, of course, when President Trump spontaneously and courageously tweeted out an invite to North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un to meet for a handshake at the demilitarized zone. Now, this totally broke the internet, and it, quote, electrified. Some headlines from some of the news agencies called it electrify the G20. Because this is just not done. Usually these meetings take months of preparation. Usually these meetings are death by committee because you have 500 different people involved from the State Department, from the Department of Defense, from the Executive Branch, from the National Security Council, and they're all trying to figure out where the flags are going to be positioned and what they're going to eat for lunch and the exact millisecond they're going to let the press go in. And that's what's called death by committee or death by bureaucracy. And what has that gotten us over the last 30 years? Worse tensions with North Korea, Where has that gotten us over the last 20 years? Not in a good direction. And just so you know, a lot of reports said Trump was mulling the strategy during the week prior to the G20. Nevertheless, it had this air of spontaneity. It had this really amazing entrepreneurial approach to static problems caused by career politicians. So the president, of course, sends out this tweet where he just says, hey, let's meet at the DMZ to say hello. Now, mind you, it's so important to remember where North Korean-American tensions were when President Trump just got elected. Where were these tensions? Were they good? Were they not so good? Well, you know, President Obama likes to take a lot of credit for things that President Trump is doing. Incorrectly take credit for things that President Trump is doing. However, if you actually look at where things stood when President Obama's term was finishing, things with North Korea were not too good. Let's listen to this clip from CNN, a short clip that articulates exactly where things were when President Trump got inaugurated.
New information tonight that Donald Trump got a dire warning about a major national security threat he'll face when he enters the Oval Office. A threat that comes from a young, impetuous dictator who executed his own uncle. U.S. intelligence officials tell CNN the White House is conveying that North Korea is a grave, near-term threat to America. The Wall Street Journal says the Obama team viewed North Korea as Trump's top national security priority and warned the Trump transition team about the threat.
And there, you heard it right there. Tensions were high. And there was not good dialogue between the two countries. And so there's no way you can possibly say things were good with North Korea upon the inauguration of Donald Trump. And so looking at that context, we also had the media almost saying it's inevitable that we would have a conflict with North Korea because of President Trump. They were saying almost that President Trump and what he was doing with calling Chairman Kim Rocket Man, what he was doing with calling the whole Korean regime opposed to freedom, this is only going to get us further and further into conflict. In fact, this is the Washington Post headline. Trump will tweet us in a nuclear war with North Korea. That was a real headline from the Washington Post. The Guardian, which is a UK-based, London-based paper, quote, risk of war with North Korea grows each day. This was the context that President Trump inherited. This was the not-so-good relations. And how did President Trump react? Well, he reacted with strong threats. He reacted with strength. And if I had to kind of summarize exactly what's going on here, President Trump embodies the peace through strength doctrine of Ronald Reagan better than any other president that I've seen. But it's really important, as the president took office, he showed the parameters of where the red lines were with engagement with the United States. Do you remember early on in his presidency, President Trump dropped the MOAB, the mother of all bombs, in Afghanistan, which killed hundreds of Taliban fighters and terrorists? Do you remember that President Trump launched two separate Tomahawk missile strikes about a year apart in Syria when they used chemical weapons against their own citizens that Bashar al-Assad did? Now, if President Trump was really cozying up to dictators, why is it at every turn President Trump would be standing up to those dictators, calling Chairman Kim Rocket Man, putting additional sanctions on Vladimir Putin, expelling Russian diplomats from the United States, closing some of the Russian embassies in the United States, arming the Ukrainian rebels against Russia, putting forth Tomahawk missiles and strikes in Syria in defiance to Vladimir Putin wishes and Bashar al-Assad wishes? And so you put all that together, President Trump really put forth a very strong approach to foreign policy on the outset of his presidency. And from that, he was able to broker peace under the foundation, because he laid a very strong foundation. This is so important. So President Trump laid the foundation of rebuilding the American military, of showing force where necessary, not putting us into endless war, not putting us into needless ground conflict. In fact, the exact opposite. He's wanted to put us away, in fact, retreat away from endless ground conflict. So that's the foundation that he built his foreign policy on. What did Barack Obama build his foreign policy on? The foundation of the Barack Obama foreign policy was going around the world and apologizing for America. That's where you started to have dictators push at every single corner, because they knew Barack Obama wasn't going to do anything about it. When you start your whole presidency, when the first thing the world sees is an apology tour, going to Egypt, going all across the world, going to Germany, saying, well, we've made so many mistakes as a country and we're going to try to right those wrongs. Or if they see a MOAB get dropped on the Taliban, who do you think is going to be able to better negotiate peace from that point forward? Plus, President Trump ripped up the horrible Iranian nuclear deal that had $150 billion in sanction relief going to Iran and over $1 billion in cash. So this set the table. So President Trump had some very heated back and forth with North Korea. And I just read you some of those headlines. But President Trump never wanted war with North Korea. He wasn't afraid to put forth military strikes if necessary. So then President Trump incrementally and deliberately and strategically worked towards dialogue and the eventual easing of tensions against North Korea. But I think this is really important. Let's take a step back, and we try to do this a lot on this show, and all of you seem to really like it, because I feel as if the media, because news media has become so digestible in 5 or 6 minute little sound bites, if you will, it's become so clickbait focused. It's hard to go into the history of why we are actually in the circumstance we are today. And that's something we did with the No War with Iran podcast. And thank you for all the positive feedback we got from that podcast. People really liked when I dove into the history of U.S.-Iranian relations. So let's do that right now. Let's actually dive in to how was North Korea actually created? Why was it created? Has the United States ever had any involvement in Korea before? And if so, was it good involvement? So the history of Korea, actually, you can go back many, many years. So we actually have poetry and writing going back nearly 8,000 years. That's right, 8,000 years. So the Korean Peninsula and the Korean people have such a rich and amazing history. But kind of more in modern history, the most famous dynasty to rule the Korean Peninsula was the Joseon Empire, the Joseon Dynasty. They ruled for 500 years. They ruled all the way up till around 1897. And then you had the creation of essentially the Korean Empire. They were pretty successful, but super short-lived. They ruled from about 1897 to 1910. So in 1910, Japan annexed the empire, annexed the Korean Peninsula. And there was the Japan-Korea Treaty of 1910. Now, you might mind you, Japan repressed a lot of Korean cultural history. There was a real mixed history here, and it's a very, very sensitive topic in South Korea. And Japan was not very good to the Korean Peninsula whatsoever, the Korean people. And then that led all the way up to the end of World War II. And so then post-World War II is really when this modern history heats up. There's a lot of important history here. I'm going to try to go through it as best as I possibly can. So 5 years after World War II, on June 25th, 1950, and a lot of this history, by the way, is thanks to our partners and friends at Prager University. I encourage all of you to check out their material. So on June 25th, 1950, the Soviet-backed North Korea invades the anti-communist neighbor South Korea, if you will. So it was similar to the divide we had today, but it wasn't as strict. It wasn't as militarized, if you will. There was the 38th parallel. It was divided into two, but there was not the military type encampment that is built today. Within weeks, the communists, which were Soviet-backed communists from the north, took over almost the entire peninsula. The United States was really unsure how to respond. I mean, the United States was really low on military budget. To give you an example, during World War II, the United States military budget was about $800 billion, $800 billion a year. It shrank down to $50 billion a year by the time this Korean conflict broke out. During World War II, there were about 8 million active troops, and it shrunk down to about 2 million troops. Now, you have to understand these numbers are in real terms, just to give you some perspective of the numbers that I'm talking about here. President Harry Truman rushed troops to Pusan to save the peninsula. So look, you have to understand, after World War II, the entire world was so wary of war, except the Soviets. The Soviets wanted more war. And you have to understand, after the fall of the Axis, after the fall of Italy, and after the fall of Nazi Germany, many parts of the world, including Korea, went up for grabs, including Vietnam and Korea and even Germany. And that's how you had the creation of East and West Germany. That's how you had the creation of the Iron Wall. That's how you had the creation of the Berlin Wall. That's how you had the creation of North and South Vietnam and North and South Korea. So after World War II, there was almost a power grab, a land grab of which ideology, the ideology of Stalinism or the ideology of democratic capitalism and the Constitutional Republic, that really is embodied in Western civilization, which idea will spread the quickest? And America was rightfully really war-weary, and we did not have any imperialist objectives or gains whatsoever. We engaged in the Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe. We did everything we could to be good stewards of the earth and good stewards of the globe and the world, but we were looking inwardly. We wanted to rebuild our own country, which eventually became the inspiration for all the Korean conflict, the inspiration for Dwight D. Eisenhower's infrastructure projects, which he built the modern highway system, so on and so forth. It was a chapter where we wanted to look inwardly. The last thing we wanted was more conflict, especially conflict in a country like Korea. But President Harry Truman realized that on the Korean Peninsula, if we lost the Korean Peninsula and we did not put forth a deterrent policy against the aggressive Soviets, we would have another problem. In fact, there was actually whispers of, oh boy, is this going to lead us to another world war? Would it lead us to World War III? And you have to understand that while the world was so wary, who was it that stepped up? And this little story I'm telling you is one of the greatest examples of American heroism, American generosity, benevolence, and interventionism. Now, mind you, I'm generally against war. I'm very much an anti-war guy, and I think everyone should be. No one should be for war. No one should actually seek out conflict. However, this example right here, this example of America getting involved in the Korean Peninsula, which led to the Korean War, is one of the most amazing examples of who we are as a people, as a country, and as a culture. So Truman rushed troops to Pusan to save the peninsula. And then on September 15th, 1950, you have to understand, all this happened in like 6 months. It was happening super quickly. General Douglas MacArthur executes the Incheon landing. He essentially retakes part of North Korea. And we took almost all of North Korea back. We were making amazing momentum. We were taking tens of miles every single day heading north. And then a big surprise happened. The Chinese Red Army pushed back. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops came out of nowhere to push the United States and our allied forces back basically to the 38th parallel. General Matthew Ridgway was one of the heroic generals, along with General Douglas MacArthur here. You have to understand, this was a very static war, or it became a very static war. Seoul, which is now the capital of South Korea, went back and forth five times. That's right, five times. Could you imagine that? Could you imagine a capital city going back and forth and having the flag that would essentially symbolize who has control of the city go back five times? How much hope and despair going back and forth there is? It's absolutely remarkable. And so in 1952 and 1953, the war went really static. And then July 27th, 1953, there was basically an armistice. There was never peace brokered. The war is actually still technically not over. And 60 years later, tensions continue between the Stalinist North, or whatever you want to call the North today, the Communist North, and the Democratic Capitalist South. You know, over 35,000 Americans died. 35,000 Americans died. And for what, people might say? Well, so that 50 million South Korean citizens could live free today. Companies like Kia, like Hyundai, like LG, like many Samsung, like many others, came out of the Democratic Capitalist limited government country of South Korea. You know, North Korea would have controlled the entire peninsula. It would have given them double the citizenry, double the resources, double the landmass to be able to put forth their horrible ideas across the world. This was a great example of the United States deterrence policy against aggressive Stalinist, Maoist, Soviet communism. And of course, all of this eventually led to the 1989 fall of the Soviet Union. Now, despite the Soviet Union falling, North Korea didn't. Believe it or not, North Korea did not fall. And this is an amazing thing. North Korea still exists to this day. They're basically a hermit kingdom. They have no freedom of the press. They have no private property. Everything is basically owned by the government. They're heavily reliant on slave labor and government repression. They're heavily reliant on the idolatry of the Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-un lineage and dynasty. And so let's walk through that for a second. So after the Axis and Allies went to war and World War II ended and Korea was kind of up for grabs, there was a leader by the name of Kim Tu-bong, who was eventually usurped and killed by Kim Il-sung. And Kim Il-sung is kind of the patriarch of modern North Korea. Kim Il-sung was two leaders ago. Kim Jong-il was the leader before. And the current leader is the boy king, Rocket Man, Chairman Kim, whatever you want to call him, Kim Jong-un. And Kim Jong-un has a real problem on his hands. And if I were to actually compare the type of behavior that Kim Jong-un is exhibiting, he looks and feels a lot like Mikhail Gorbachev back in the 1980s. Someone who was many decades into a failed experiment, someone who sees the world changing rapidly around them, someone who sees his own grip on power deteriorating and is trying to reach outwardly to come to some form of agreement or consensus to save his country, save face, and not have himself and his whole family dynasty taken over. If I had to summarize it here, here's the whole thesis of what is going on here, and the press will never tell you this. Trump is finishing Reagan's vision of crushing communism with peace through strength. President Reagan destroyed the Soviet Union without ever firing a shot directly at the Soviets. Now, mind you, we had a lot of proxy conflicts against the Soviets. Mind you, we had a lot of heated exchanges. We had a lot of arms treaties. You have to understand the type of coverage that we see actually going after President Trump and his heroic meeting to try to thaw the tensions with North Korea is the exact same sort of antagonism that was thrown at President Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. If I look at right here, May 21st, 1984, Time magazine, Straub Talbot, on U.S.-Soviet relations. He says, quote, "The Reagan administration has made a bad situation worse in two ways. First, by convincing the Soviet leaders that U.S. can no longer accept military parity as the basis of relations with Moscow. Second, by challenging the legitimacy of the Soviet regime, calling the USSR, quote, an evil empire doomed to fail." And so, look, you could literally put these, you could put this very same article that was I just read right here into Time magazine today about the Iranians or about Donald Trump. The journalists have not changed. It's just the name, the script that they are using has not changed. That's the better way to word it. The script that they are using has not changed. The only thing that has changed is just minor details and the countries and the actors. The activist journalists that were attacking Ronald Reagan for reaching out personally to Mikhail Gorbachev to actually broker peace, to actually put forth a huge nuclear arms treaty, one of the biggest that ended up happening in 1987, are the same people that are writing today. The players have changed. Their agenda has not. I can go through article by article of how the press attacked President Ronald Reagan. Here's another one right here. Time editor-at-large Straub Talbot, again, on Inside Washington, September 21st, 1991. "The Soviet Union collapsed. The Cold War ended almost overwhelmingly because of internal contradictions and pressures within the Soviet Union and the Soviet system itself. And even if Jimmy Carter had been reelected and followed by Walter Mondale, something like that is what we probably would have seen what happened." He's just totally wrong. Anyone who has studied Soviet history knows that President Ronald Reagan, through economic power, through having the best economy in American history through the 1980s, it's such an example of revisionist history. And this is exactly what's going on today. It's exactly what's going on today. And I go to this specific headline right here. Reagan flubs Reykjavik summit. Remember, Reagan walked away from the Reykjavik summit with Mikhail Gorbachev because there was not enough concessions. And this was Rolling Stone. This is a Rolling Stone headline. Reagan flubs Reykjavik summit. Weren't people saying the exact same thing with President Trump with his summit in Hanoi? The coverage is exactly the same. The left does not change, folks. The left simply does not change. Their tactics are the same. Their language is the same. Just some of the players have changed. The left has always been cheering for the other side against the incumbent Republican president to try to broker peace. And just look at some of these headlines over the weekend right here. "Trump's dictator envy isn't funny anymore," Slate.com. "Democrats skeptical of Trump outreach to Kim," that's AP News. "Trump just made Kim's job a lot easier." So what is the significance of this? What actually is the important geopolitical significance? When you're talking to another country, when you're having dialogue with another country, you're far less likely to go to war with that country. And you have to understand the failed foreign policy of Bush and Cheney is you can't talk to the other side. In fact, let's play a soundbite right now of Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who's the daughter of Dick Cheney, who embodies his basically all of his views, who says negotiating with the Taliban is a mistake. She's totally wrong, by the way. We met with the Taliban all throughout the 1990s before we ever went into the reckless war in Afghanistan. You should always be talking to, people if you have different ideas. Always. Even if they're your bitter enemies, you should always have some form of dialogue. And the last option, the very last option, should always be war. The very last option. Let's play the sound of Liz Cheney.
I think, first of all, President Trump has had tremendous success across the board on a whole range of national security issues. He was absolutely right to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement, absolutely right to withdraw, to announce that we will withdraw from the INF. He's had tremendous success and has done exactly the right thing in terms of resources for the Pentagon over the last 2 years. And so I support very much what he's done there. Al-Qaeda is embedded with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Taliban will not live up to any negotiated deal that we set with them. The notion that we're somehow going to have a negotiated deal with the Taliban, that we can take their word that they won't allow Al-Qaeda to have safe havens again, is, in my view, irresponsible.
And there you heard right there. You had Liz Cheney basically say, well, we should never be talking to the Taliban. And I'm sure that many people on the more neoconservative wing of the Republican Party feel exactly the same way with Donald Trump. And they're echoing that, saying that Donald Trump, you know, meeting with Chairman Kim is incorrect. When you have dialogue with a country, you're far less likely to go to war with that country. And this goes back to the doctrine of America first. Putting America first means not shipping off our citizens to a reckless war across the world. Putting America first means not furthering our country into these international calamities that push some sort of other quasi-globalist agenda and not one that really protects the sovereignty of our own country. Admit it, you think that cybercrime is something that happens to other people. This is so important. Listen to this. You may think that no one wants your data or that hackers can't grab your passwords or credit card details. But look, you're just so wrong. You need to protect your stuff right now. Your iPhone, your iPad, your computer. You probably hear people talking about this and you roll your eyes. You're like, yeah, okay. You know what? That's what people said about locks on their homes 30 years ago. You need a lock on your computer. You need a lock on your iPhone. And that's what you need. What I use all the time, every single day. What is it? ExpressVPN. A VPN will secure and anonymize your searches, your tablets, your computer, your phone. Everything you need, your internet browsing, by encrypting your data. It encrypts your data, which is so important, and hides your public IP address. Using ExpressVPN, I could safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on and having my personal data stolen. For less than $7 a month, you can get the same ExpressVPN protection that I have. ExpressVPN is the number one rated VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get the ExpressVPN that I use. I'm using it right now by going to expressvpn.com/Charlie. That's expressvpn.com/Charlie, expressvpn.com/Charlie for 3 months free. It's amazing. 1 year package, like getting free money. You need a lock on your bike. You need a lock on your car. You need a lock on your house. Well, why don't you have a lock on your computer? Go to expressvpn.com/Charlie to learn more. Go do it now. And I want to go back to the point that I was making earlier, that President Donald Trump is finishing Reagan's amazing work from the 1980s to crush communism, not just domestically against the radical ideas of AOC and Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, and Cory Booker, but also to crush communism through a multivariable formula abroad. President Ronald Reagan was the top communist crusher ever, probably, but definitely in the 20th century, obviously, because the 20th century is the only time that we've seen communism really tried the way that it was. And President Ronald Reagan's strategy was quite simple. Number one, make our economy the greatest in the world. That was the first part of the equation. So what did Ronald Reagan do? He cut taxes. He deregulated the economy. He became America's number one cheerleader. And he allowed American businesses and entrepreneurs to thrive. You had President Jimmy Carter. You had stagflation. You had interest rates upwards to 10 to 15 to 20%. What did President Ronald Reagan do? Reversed that completely. So that's the first part of the President Reagan, President Trump equation. What did President Trump do? Deregulated the economy. President Donald Trump cut 22 regulations for every new one regulation put on the books. President Donald Trump enacted the largest tax decrease and the largest tax cut in American history for middle class workers, for corporate tax rates down to 21%. And the results have been unbelievable. While the rest of the world has mediocre economic growth, the United States of America is experiencing the greatest economy in world history. So that's the first. It's a three-part equation. It's a three-input formula and equation that President Ronald Reagan had. That number one is the economics. Number two is the military might. You might not have to use it, but you sure better have it. So President Ronald Reagan, just like President Donald Trump, rebuilt the American military. Rebuilt the American military and was not afraid to strategically use it to show that force, to show that when red lines are crossed, you will indeed use the American military. President Ronald Reagan used it against Libya. President Donald Trump used it against Syria, strategically, without getting the United States into endless wars. Mind you, President Ronald Reagan never put the United States in an endless ground conflict, but he did use American military might when necessary, when our bases were threatened, or embassies were bombed, or our assets were put into jeopardy. President Donald Trump, exactly the same. So the first input is economic powerhouse. Make our economy number one in the world. Number two is the military might. And number three is dialogue, dialogue, dialogue. Have dialogue with the people that you are pitted up against. And President Ronald Reagan, like President Donald Trump, believed this exactly. But you also have to have clear objectives of what success looks like. President Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire. President Donald Trump called North Korea a hermit kingdom and said that their ideas are backwards. President Ronald Reagan said that one day the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and all of their proxies around the world will live in prosperity. President Donald Trump says that North Korea can soon be like Singapore and live in a free market democratic capitalist state. And so you have dialogue mixed with vision. And what does that equal? It equals peace. The Obama doctrine is exactly the opposite. Economic mediocrity, send billions of dollars around the globe, destroy our own military, don't show any force, and cozy up to people that bitterly hate our country, give them hundreds of billions of dollars, and don't even have and then don't have dialogue with others. The Obama doctrine is the Carter doctrine, which actually makes America more likely to go into war, that actually makes America more likely to go into conflict. And finally, the Obama-Carter doctrine is to leave Israel and our allies behind, is not to actually consolidate the consensus and consolidate these coalitions together. So what is President Trump doing? It's as if President Ronald Reagan stopped being president in 1988 and the world went in a wrong direction. And then in January 2017, when President Trump took the oath of office, all of a sudden things turned completely. It's like President Ronald Reagan's ideas came back into the Oval Office completely. Because they were absent during the Bush years. They were absent during the Clinton years. It's as if the successful doctrine of Ronald Reagan was completely forgotten, and President Trump dusted off this manual and has been implementing it brilliantly. And President Reagan's vision of making America a free society is being fulfilled thanks to President Donald Trump. President Reagan's international vision of crushing communism to making sure more people can live free without ever firing a missile, without ever firing a shot, is also becoming fulfilled. And as we wrap up this flash episode of the Charlie Kirk Show, now that you've heard the history of North Korea, now you understand the historical significance of what President Trump is doing to complete the vision of Ronald Reagan. And now, mind you, Ronald Reagan was someone who was mocked by the media. Ronald Reagan was someone who actually survived a real assassination attempt. President Ronald Reagan was joked to be a cowboy who didn't know what he was doing, reckless in the Oval Office, losing his mental capacity. Does any of that sound familiar? Does any of those attacks sound familiar? President Trump and Ronald Reagan are one in the same. They would have been best friends if they met each other during the primes of their life. They both kind of dabbled in Hollywood. They were both excellent on TV. I guarantee you President Reagan would have been fascinated by the use of Twitter. And so with all of that being said, I want to replay the soundbite of the American left and how they describe President Donald Trump. I want to replay what Kamala Harris says about Donald Trump.
We talked about, you asked before, what is the greatest national security threat to the United States? It's Donald Trump. And I'm going to tell you why. Because I agree, climate change represents an existential threat. He denies the science. You want to talk about North Korea? Real threat in terms of nuclear arsenal. But what does he do? He embraces Kim Jong-un, a dictator, for the sake of a photo op. Putin, you want to talk about
Senator
Russia?
Harris, we're going to
he takes the word of the Russian president over the word of the American intelligence community when it comes to a threat to our democracy and our election.
And there she goes, Kamala Harris, talking about Donald Trump being the greatest existential threat to our country. While he's brokering peace, while he's revitalized our economy, while he's put our country back on the right track. Make no mistake, if Hillary Clinton was president, we would be at war with either North Korea, Iran, or somewhere else across the world. While President Trump is trying to de-escalate tensions against these bad actors, the Democrats and Hillary Clinton would recklessly get us into those conflicts. I want to ask you a question. Does it take more courage to meet with an enemy or not meet with an enemy? What takes more courage? Does it take more clarity of thought? Does it take more confidence to actually go to the DMZ and shake Chairman Kim's hand? He could have been stood up. He could have been left alone there. He could have been laid out to dry. Does it take more courage to do that or to not do that? And this reminds me of a writing from the great Cicero. Cicero, of course, was consul of Rome. He was a best-selling author during the time, and he kind of predicted the fall of the Roman Empire. And one of his favorite quotes was this, and this is when he's talking about diplomacy and reaching out to enemies, essentially. Don't be afraid to reach out to your opponents. Pride and stubbornness are a luxury you cannot afford. And isn't that amazing? Because it's exactly the opposite of the attack with Donald Trump. They say that he's so self-interested. He's so erratic. And here's the guy that calmly and coolly, in such a collected way, goes to the demilitarized zone and steps foot into North Korea. And what's the media coverage on it? And what's the way the Democrat Party continues to interpret it? As dictator appeasement. They said the same thing about Ronald Reagan. When President Reagan met with Mikhail Gorbachev, when John F. Kennedy met with Khrushchev in the 1960s, they said the exact same thing. When they say Donald Trump is dictator appeasing, you have to understand that President Donald Trump has put intense sanctions on North Korea. There were missile tests frequently under the Obama administration. Now we are talking, and now we are closer towards a unified Korea than we have ever been. And finally, we have a president that is solving these complex problems using timeless philosophy, the philosophy of just war theory from Aquinas and Augustine. We'll do a whole podcast on that soon, which is so important. And the idea of just war is one that we must get back to, that you should not use war as a device of aggression, but only one as defense. And if every country used the just war theory, there would be no more war. If every country actually embraced just war theory, that you're only going to go to war if you yourself are attacked, then think about it. If everyone did that, then there would be technically no more war. Of course, if all men were angels, we wouldn't actually need laws, and that would never happen. But the more countries that can embrace that theory, the vision of Aquinas and Augustine, which was originally articulated by Cicero, even in the Roman Empire, is so, so important. And after victory, you have to understand, after victory, you have more enemies than before victory. That's such an important point. After victory, you have more enemies. How are you going to deal with those? You're going to deal with those by continuing to recklessly and endlessly go into these conflicts and wars? And mind you, that was a Cicero quote, after victory, you have more enemies. I want to make sure I give proper attribution. Instead, President Donald Trump is using the timeless equation that was perfected by Ronald Reagan and implementing it on the global stage today. Our country is better because of it, and the world has been looking for this leader for the last 30 years. The world has been aimlessly searching for a leader with moral conviction that loves freedom and with the strength and the capacity and the resolve and the courage to back it up. And that leader is President Donald Trump. Thank you guys so much for listening today to this flash edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. It's just amazing to see the president make history to go to North Korea. And finally, we will see that vision. A good leader is a leader that puts forth the vision of success, and the vision is a unified Korea, and that will happen large in part thanks to President Donald Trump. Don't take my word for it. President Moon from South Korea says President Donald Trump is the peacemaker of Korea. It's so amazing to see these gains actually be accomplished. Please give us 5 stars. We so greatly appreciate it. Put your comments in the comment section. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with more episodes later this week. Please give us 5 stars. It helps us out so much. Thank you, guys. We'll be back very soon.
It was a crime no one expected, and one many can't forget. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, a new podcast from WTOP News and Podcast One, details the heinous murders of a D.C. power couple, their 10-year-old son, and housekeeper inside their own home. The complicated trail of evidence.
She thinks she knows how Darren Wint got inside the house.
Oh my God, I saw Amy yesterday.
And shocking moments from the trial.
His defense team drops a bombshell.
Will this investigation lead to the release of confidential audio recordings from the case?
So it's under general counsel review. I mean, I'm committing to making a transparent court.
22 Hours, An American Nightmare. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts today.